Welcome to the current federal tax developments for the week after Thanksgiving, the week of November 26, 2018. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'm bringing you the current developments this week, being sponsored by Kaplan Professional Education and by your State Society of CPAs. It was a short week, and not a whole lot happened last week in taxes, but we did have a couple of things go on, so we're going to talk a little bit about those. First thing, probably the biggest thing for most of you is going to be that we had the release of the proposed anti-clawback regulations. If you do any estate planning, that's a significant issue for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act because it looks at how the IRS is going to address the anti-clawback rules. We also will discuss the final 263 Cap A negative amount regulations issued. These have been in proposed form since 2012, so after sitting out there for 6 years, the IRS finally took them final, so we'll discuss briefly what's in there. And finally, the long and winding road of the 163J proposed regulations is apparently now one step closer. No, it didn't make it out a couple of days after it was, you know, after we talked about it last week, supposed to come out. And it didn't make it by Thanksgiving. But what did happen by Thanksgiving is it finally left the Office of Management and Budget. And so because of that, we should hopefully sometime here soon actually have these regulations. Let's get started and talk about what was the big story of the week, which really are the changes that we're going to see here for the new proposed regulations for the anti-clawback rules. This is Regulation 106-706-18, published by the IRS on the 15th of November. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as you all should be aware, temporarily increased the basic exclusion amount for estate taxes. As you're aware, the basic exclusion amount was set at $5 million back in 2010. The Tax Cuts, and it's been inflation adjusted since that point. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act jumped that 5 to 10 and then inflation adjusted that. That means that this year, for decedents dying this year or for gifts made this year, the limitation is $11,180,000. And as we recently discovered, next year that limitation will be $11,400,000. But this is all scheduled to revert back to a lower level in 2026. That creates a problem that we know called clawback. The problem with clawback is that technically this problem could, you know, a big problem could come up. When you do an estate tax return, as you should recall, we add up the lifetime gifts of an individual and then we subtract from that the estate taxes, you know, the amounts that the gifts they've made. We do those lifetime gifts. We give them credit for the gift tax paid actually in that time. And then we take the unified credit, which is based on the basic exclusion amount. The catch is, if I've made gifts of $11,180,000 this year, and then I live to 2026, my estate now, let's say, actually has nothing left in it. If we just recomputed the estate tax in 2026, when let's say the estate tax exclusion might be $5,600,000 or $5,700,000, there's going to be a whole bunch in excess of that I gave during my life. There's going to be no gift tax to offset it. So in theory, there would be this huge estate tax due. Now, if my estate's bankrupt, that is actually a bit of a problem because in theory, they could pursue it against the parties who got the gifts years ago. At least that'd be an argument. But probably worse than that, because I doubt they would have, you know, I think that would have been difficult for them. But worse than that, let's say I really had, you know, $3 or $4 million left in the estate. Suddenly that $3 to $4 million left in the estate would suddenly now be yanked back to pay estate taxes that really never should have been due. So Congress directed the IRS to write anti-clawback regulations. Congress faced criticism back when EGTRA was passed, the Economic Growth Recovery, the Economic Growth Tax Act. I got to remember what the Bush title really was. Always referred to it as EGTRA, and it's been a while. But back when that was passed in 2001, there was a lot of discussion that Congress didn't deal with this. Had the rates actually reverted to $1 million, we would have seen basically a much bigger problem. You know, we would have seen this sort of clawback problem. Now, obviously, that never became an issue because we never had it actually. Well, I guess we did have it reduced because we had 1 year where there was an unlimited estate tax, but the catch was you couldn't make gifts at that level. So the anti-clawback issues were less of a problem. Now we're going to get rules. So the IRS set out to write the rules. And what the IRS did this time was the IRS decided that there were four scenarios that theoretically could cause a problem. And so the IRS set about looking at the four scenarios. And what the IRS determines is three of the scenarios really don't have an impact. If the level goes down, in essence, the code self-heals, shall we say, in those scenarios. But they did find one rule, one situation where there would have been a major clawback problem without changes in the rules. So the IRS now has developed these new rule changes. So in the regulation that we've got, let's take a look at the first scenario. This case talked about, wait, you'd paid gift tax in prior years that now would not have been due. And now you go ahead and you make another gift. So let's say that you had actually made $5+ million worth of gifts. And, you know, you had totally exhausted your regular exclusion, you know, based on that. So we were done with that. Now you've gone and you make another really big, you make a gift next year, but you've already paid gift tax on $2 million. You know, now the question becomes, did you lose that? If I make a $5 million gift now, am I going to have to pay gift tax on parts of that because I made a $2 million gift before, even though I paid gift tax on that? And the IRS outlines that doesn't really cause a problem. What they say is, you know, the step three of determining of gift tax requires a tentative tax on all gifts from prior period to be subtracted from tentative tax and cumulative gifts, okay? The gifts from prior period include those pre-2018 gifts in which gift tax was paid. In this way, the full amount of the gift tax liability on the pre-2018 gifts is removed from the current year gift tax computation. Regardless of where that liability was sheltered from the gift tax by the basic exclusion amount and or was satisfied by gift payments. And then the remaining steps 4 through 6 determination require, in effect, that the basic exclusion amount for the current year be reduced by the basic exclusion amount in prior periods against the gifts that were made by the donor in those periods. The increased exclusion amount was not available in the earlier years and thus not allowable against these gifts. Accordingly, we're not losing BEA in this situation. And that's something actually that's potentially been a problem for a while, but the IRS explains that's not really an issue. The gift tax mechanically takes care of that, so we don't have a problem. So let's go on to the second scenario. What happens if somebody dies having made those pre-2018 gifts? And the IRS says, well, that's not really negatively affected either. As they say in the preamble, step three of the estate tax determination requires that the hypothetical gift tax on decedent's post-1976 taxable gifts be subtracted from the tentative tax on the sum of the taxable estate and adjusted taxable gifts. The post-1976 gifts include the pre-2018 gifts in which gift tax was paid. In this way, the full amount of gift tax liability in the pre-2018 gifts is removed from the estate tax computation, regardless of where that liability was sheltered from gift tax by the basic exclusion amount and or was satisfied by gift tax payment. Okay, then step four requires that a credit on the amount of the basic exclusion amount, you know, a credit on the amount of the basic exclusion amount for the year of the decedent's death be subtracted from the net tentative tax due. As a result, the IRS notes, the only time the increased basic exclusion amount enters into the computation of the estate tax is when the credit on the amount of the basic exclusion amount allowable in the year of the decedent's death is netted against the tentative estate tax, which in turn already has been reduced by the hypothetical gift tax on the full amount of those post-1977 gifts, whether or not gift tax was paid. Thus, the IRS points out, the increased basic exclusion amount is not reduced by the portion of any prior gift on which gift tax was paid, and the full amount of that exclusion is available for credit against the estate tax. So, scenario two, again, no problem. Okay, IRS goes on to their third scenario. In this case, you made post-2018 gifts using the higher exclusion. Then you make additional gifts after 2025. So, I make my gifts now, right? I do those post-2018 gifts using the higher exclusion. Then I make additional gifts at 2025. Is the clawback going to happen as soon as I do a 709? The IRS says, actually, no, that's not going to be a problem. They again point out, just as in the first situation, the gift tax computation will solve this problem. You know, they're saying that effectively, it's not going to be, by the mechanics of that computation, the same thing they described in the first one, we're going to essentially not burn up the BEA, basic exclusion amount, and we're not going to force them to go back and repay old gift tax. So that's not a problem. But the IRS does come up with, and this is the thing that caused everybody to freak out before, there is one scenario where, absent a change in the law, is if gifts are made post-2018, it uses that increased base exclusion amount. So we make gifts of $7 million for a decedent. And, you know, he makes gifts of $7 or $8 million during this time period when exclusion is higher. That person then dies in 2026. Now the problem raises its specter. In this case, this would result in a clawback. In this situation, we would again look at lifetime gifts. And once we did that and took out gift tax actually paid, and there wasn't any actually paid, we would then, if we use the regular BEA at this point, the base exclusion amount, what's going to happen is we're going to find that we don't have enough of it, right, to offset the prior gifts, and there'd be tax due. So the IRS says, you know, this is going to be a problem. So what the IRS does in this case is, right, is when gifts are made post-2018, it uses the BEA. You know, what we're going to do is follow the following solution, right, in the proposed regs. What we're going to do, it's going to be a bottom-up solution. Now, some people have tried to argue for maybe we should do a top-down. What's the difference? A bottom-up solution says if I give $4 million while the exclusion's at 11, with a bottom-up exclusion, I'm going to have between $1 and $2 million of exclusion left when we go back to the regular taxable estate by having given the regular BEA when having given four. But if it had been top down, I would have been assumed to have used that extra exclusion. So I would have retained the full 5.7, 5.8 million, whatever it is in 2026 for that purpose. Obviously, some people were rooting for the bottom up, for the top down structure, because then clients who made gifts during this time period would be able to lock in the higher exclusion numbers without having to actually give $11 million, 11 plus million dollars to lock it all in. If you made a gift of $5.6 or $7 million, you would burn up the higher exclusion, and then you'd still have the full lower, the reduced exclusion to go. That's not the way the IRS went. It certainly is. I'm certain there are going to be people disappointed that it went that way, but I also think clearly the IRS, you know, is not clearly wrong in going with a bottom-up fix. In essence, the IRS's theory was our job is to keep people from paying extra tax, not to basically open up a way to allow people to, you know, kind of come up with a system that would allow them to lock in permanently an exclusion that's supposed to go away in 2026. So what happens if you die after 2020, if you die in 2026 or later, the exclusion amount for that year is the greater of the actual base exclusion amount in the year of death, or the imputed base exclusion amount based on prior gifts. So if you had made prior gifts of $8 million, instead of computing your credit based on, let's say, $5.8 million, we compute your credit based on the $8 million worth of gifts you gave during the time period when we had that exclusion at 11 point whatever million. So in essence, if you have used the base exclusion amount against gifts, all those lifetime gifts you use the BEA against are added up, and then they're compared to the actual BEA in the year of death, and we use the higher of those two. It is a simple fix, relatively elegant fix, shall we say, and it's what's happening. Now, comments obviously are going to be taken on this, and certainly there's some time before this would become part of the law, because it doesn't matter till 2026. We'll see if people try to argue for a top-down structure, and if the IRS were to go along with that. My guess is they won't go along with it, but certainly I expect somebody to argue some comments to suggest a top-up solution, a top-down solution. More likely, what we're going to see here is they're going to stick with this bottom-up. The top-down solution had been suggested in a number of publications, including in tax notes, areas where I think the IRS, you know, most likely sees the commentary, and so would likely have understood that was out there. So I don't believe we're going to get a top-down fix, but we are going to get a bottom-up fix. So if that's the case, it does mean that if somebody wants to really lock in the 11 plus million dollar exclusion, they're going to actually have to give that away before 2026. Obviously, you could lock in part of it by going partway there, but you've got to burn through the whole lower exclusion before you're going to get any lock-in. Next up, the IRS did issue final 2638 regulations. And I'm not too excited about this, because I think for a lot of us who have small taxpayers, the $25 million get out of 263 Cap A option beginning this year will mean that a lot fewer taxpayers worry about 263 Cap A. But if you are worried about it, the final regulations were issued on November 19th. That's Treasury Decision 9843. What these do, that goes back to 2012, they bar the use of negative adjustments, right? Of negative amounts for calculating additional 263 Cap A cost if you're not using or able to use the simplified production method. Okay. So you're not allowed to use those negative costs unless you're using SPF. And again, under the old rules, you couldn't use FPF if your revenues were above 10 million. Okay. Now, one change now is to raise the dollar amount for SPF to 25 million, which actually isn't much of a change because, as I said, under the rules of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as long as you're below 25 million, you could just elect not to use 263 Cap A entirely. This may be helpful for people who are, you know, don't want to make that change because they're afraid they're going to go over eventually. And at least for a few years prior to going over, they could use SPF and make use of those negative adjustments if they have it. Not sure I'd get too excited. Again, remember, under the accounting method changes we have in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, taxpayers with average revenues of less than 25 million can simply opt out of 263 Cap A. Okay. Now, so the new accounting method options make this less significant. The IRS also gave us at the same time new automatic change methods. So if you do need to change your methods to come into line with this Treasury decision, take a look at it. If you are subject to 263 Cap A and you do have these negative amounts that you're using for additional 263 Cap A costs, if you have been using those, please go back, take a look at these regs. They are 80 pages. Really means the way that final regs work. It's probably closer to 40 pages of real regs because there'll be about 40 pages of explanations or even more than that quite often. You know, in the preamble, those explanations are helpful, but obviously the real regs are not quite 80 pages long, but you're going to probably slog through 80 pages. So, you know, have fun with it. Finally, we mentioned last week that, hey, these new 163J regs on the interest limitations are supposedly coming out soon. Well, it said any day now, and we've been sitting on any day now for a while, and they haven't come. But in an article in Tax Notes Today, published on November 26th, Emily Foster, in the article Proposed Regs Limiting Interest Deductions Depart OIRA, notes that the Office of Management Budgets Division Office, OIRA, has basically now released the regs. Remember, they have to study them and approve them. They kicked them out the day before Thanksgiving per their website. So we're going to have those regs coming. This is the last step before issuance. So if we're lucky, they did not appear Friday, but I'm not sure how many people were working at the IRS on Friday. We're going to be hopeful they're going to appear here this week. We'll see. It usually takes a couple of days for them to appear once the OMB has given their blessing. Okay. Now, it went to them with 480 pages, but the speculation is it will be longer coming out. OMB has normally been requiring them to have more description about why the service decided to handle something the way they did. So we're probably going to have closer to 500 pages when it comes out. They did not make Thanksgiving, but we're hopeful for this week. If you have a taxpayer who is affected by the interest limitations, now remember, taxpayers with average revenues of less than 25 million are not impacted by this. So that's good news for that group. As well, certain other taxpayers can opt out. We have various other complex rules that get in play. If you need to worry about this, though, and I think a lot of us probably will need to worry about it for at least some clients, you do need to take a look at these regulations when they come out in proposed form, about 500 pages. Hopefully, it will happen this week, and hopefully that gives me some reading material because I'm going to be doing courses around the country. Actually, this week, I'm doing the U.S. Virgin Islands is where I'm going to be doing courses, one on St. Thomas, one on St. Croix. So I may have some reading materials flying between the islands, or flying back to Phoenix from there, because that's a nice long trip when I come back. So I have plenty of time to read. So we'll see if I have some regs to read. Maybe I'll have some discussion next week on those regs. Now, remember, we're now here at the end of, we're coming up on the end of the main CPE season now. We're about to enter December. It's winter time, and those of you, especially in the Chicago area, Chicago, Kansas City, and the various Midwest that got hit by the storm, this weekend. You really know it's winter time. It's now arrived. But you want to make sure you sign up for your state CPE, your state CPA Society CPE courses here these last couple of weeks, or maybe or in early January. Again, lots of things happening on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, lots of rules coming out. There are lots of things to get updated on. We're crossing our fingers that sometime in December, we will get the final regulations on 199 Cap A for the 20%, and that will be interesting to see what changes there. But just check, see what's available in your state society and sign up. Lots of things. There's lots of guidance we need this year. So make sure you get your guidance from your state society courses. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for this week. You can follow my regular updates when I post them online. I'll write them up at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can email them to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I'm on Twitter at edzollers is where you can follow me. And I also follow discussions on the subreddit at reddit.com/r/taxpros. I also follow a number of state CPA societies, discussion groups, Cal CPAs at Tax Talk. I follow the Arizona Society, New Jersey Society, and Minnesota Society discussions on their Connect site. So if you have anything there, you have questions, and you're a member of those societies, just check in and we'll see, you know, post your questions and I'll see them and hopefully be able to help the discussion go about answering and solving those. Otherwise, take care. Have fun this week. We're at the end of November. It's actually the year's going by fast. Tax planning season has arrived. So have fun with your clients and planning. And as we try to figure out this law, and join us next week as we'll try to talk some more about the current federal tax developments that occur in the week.